All right, nice to see everyone. Welcome. Nice to see everyone online. So this is this last month topic on the worldly winds is a great way to end this year-long exploration of Dharma and daily life. Because so much of the things we struggle with in our daily lives do have to do with these eight winds, these winds of gain and loss, of fame and shame, of praise and blame, and pleasure and pain. You know, so much of our lives as human beings are trying to get more of those positive attributes and try to avoid those other ones. And yet the Buddha has this beautiful sutta that we'll explore tonight. It's almost the image of like sitting in the middle of a forest and you're a tree letting the wind blow you this way and that way. And yet you're very firmly rooted into the ground. You're finding that root, that sense of grounding. And that's what our practice is designed to give us, is that capacity to stay rooted in the midst of these changing winds. And of course, those winds sometimes are very painful, very personal. They just carry so much tenderness. And sometimes they carry some of our deepest hopes. And so this is also part of the practice, is to learn how to explore those, how to use that in itself as a spiritual practice. So the Buddha taught about these eight worldly winds, also called the eight vicissitudes. And he said that they arise for all of us. Doesn't matter if we're rich or poor, if we're, you know, whatever characteristic we might have, whatever circumstances we might have, we have these winds. And whatever our level of practice is. So even if we've never practiced before, we've never have any kind of inclination toward Dharma practice or any kind of spirituality, these winds will affect us. They will buffet us. And someone who's practiced very deeply will also experience these same winds. Even someone like the Buddha will still experience them. So the question is, how do we meet those? Do we meet them with wisdom, with compassion, with a sense of clear seeing, with skillfulness, or with reactivity, with trying to hold on to or to fight against them? So there's this sutta that really covers this eight worldly winds very well. And it was online, I think Dara put a link for you, and also the homework. You can find that just by typing in that sutta. The title is the Lokavipata Sutta. And the way this translator translated that is the failings of the world. The failings of the world. Isn't that an interesting title? You know, how the world has these failings. And we can look at that in different ways. I like to look at it as just the conditioned quality of the world, that things are always arising and passing away. When we place our hopes on some of those things staying stable, we're going to be buffeted by these winds as they arise and as they pass away. So the Buddha, as so many of these suttas starts with, he's talking to a group of monks and nuns. And he says that these eight worldly conditions spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. Isn't that interesting? The spinning after the world, and the world spins after them. Remember, the Buddha would sometimes talk about the world as this way that we create really our own reality through our history, our perception, our biases, our prejudices, our conditioning, and how we were raised, you know, the culture, the experiences of trauma, whatever it is, creates the way we perceive the world. And so often we don't see the world how it actually is. We see it through those projections, through those ideas. And so in this way, this idea of the world spinning off after these vicissitudes, after these worldly winds, and the world spinning after them and them spinning after the world makes so much sense. Because these eight, as you reflect on those really generate a lot of our world making. You know, it's thinking about how much we try to have gain in our lives, how much we try to avoid loss, how much we try to seek fame and avoid disgrace, how we seek after praise and avoid blame and pleasure and pain. And so much of our way we are in the world revolve around these eight. And the Buddha goes on to say which eight. So there's different translations of these eight. So I won't be super consistent, but I'll be fairly consistent. So gain, loss, status, disgrace, praise, blame, and pleasure and pain. That status and disgrace sometimes is fame and shame, fame and disrepute. So that sense of being well-renowned versus being in the opposite of that. So these are the eight worldly winds that spin after the world. The world spins after them. Now here's where it gets interesting, because the Buddha says that for an uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, so that's kind of the code phrase for just an ordinary person who hasn't practiced, who's just kind of lost in their mind states. An uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, these eight arise. Also, for a well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, there also arises these same eight. Right? It's such an important thing that we can't escape these, even though we're deeply practiced, even though we have deep insights or our deep meditative practice or whatever spiritual practice you might have. These eight still will come into your life, regardless of, you know, how holy or special you might be. But what is the difference? What is the distinction? What is the distinguishing factor between the well-instructed disciple and the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person? Right? So then the sutta takes these two and explores them. So the first one, for the run-of-the-mill person, so when gain arises, he or she doesn't reflect. Gain has arisen in me. And this is a simple thing of just stepping back. This is our mindfulness practice, stepping back and noticing, oh, gain is present, or loss is present, or fame is here, or disrepute, or praise is here, or blame is here, pleasure is here, or pain is here. If we haven't practiced or we lose our grounding in our practice, we become absorbed in these states. We don't realize that they've arisen, and we don't realize that they're inconsistent, stressful, and subject to change. So these three aspects of inconsistent, stressful, and subject to change. It's usually pointing toward that conditionality of experience. Another way of saying it, that it's all inherently dukkha. So we think of dukkha as suffering, but dukkha also means that it's not substantial, that it arises and it passes away. Anything that does that, even something that's really beautiful and exciting and wholesome, also at some point will fade. So we don't discern what it is as it actually is. So gain has, so the run-of-the-mill person does not reflect, gain has arisen for me. It is inconsistent, stressful, and subject to change. He or she does not discern how it actually is. Do not discern how it actually is. And we'll unpack this a little bit more. But one of the big things that we confuse it with is being very personal as definitions of who and what we are. I'm a person worthy of praise. I'm worthy of fame, of gain. Or the opposite, I'm unworthy of all of those. And so then with all of these eight, the loss arises, status arises, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure. So we do not reflect. Pain has arisen for me. It is inconsistent, stressful, and subject to change. So you do not discern how it is. Now from that point of not really seeing it clearly, what follows from that is that Buddha continues, is that our minds remain consumed with the gain. Our minds remain consumed with the gain, with the loss, with the status, etc. And then further, that we rebel against the risen gain and rebel against the unrisen loss. Okay, so we've set up a polarity. Again, this is very natural as human beings. So we have strong preferences for four of these eight, right? And strong dislike for the other four. So we welcome the risen gain. We welcome that we and rebel against the arisen loss. We welcome the risen status and rebel against the risen disgrace. We welcome the risen praise and rebel against the risen censure. We welcome the risen pleasure and rebels against the risen pain. So, I mean, if I'm honest, this kind of describes most of my experience with these worldly winds. That, you know, I welcome the good ones and rebel against the difficult ones. Right? And so by doing that, by engaging that way, by welcoming and rebelling, we're not released from birth, aging, or death, from sorrows, lamentations, pain, distress, or despairs. And we're not released from suffering and stress. So this little line here, really, if, for those familiar with dependent origination, it's that last section of dependent origination from birth, aging, and death, and then from sorrow, lamentations, pain, and distress. So he's describing this mechanism of dukkha, of suffering. This is the whole point of his teaching, is to understand the nature of it and to understand the release of it. So this is the run-of-the-mill person. Now, the contrast of that is the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, you know, someone who's practiced deeply and integrated that practice. So right from the bat, they reflect, okay, gain has arisen for me. And they see clearly it is inconsistent. It is stressful. It is subject to change. He or she discerns it how it actually is. Right? Same thing with loss, with status, disgrace, censure, praise, and pleasure. And pain. And by seeing it clearly, the mind is not consumed with that gain. You know, there's a sense of seeing it clearly, we don't become obsessed with it. We don't become lost in it. And then with all the eight. And here, the next line is what we do not welcome the risen gain or rebel against the risen loss. Okay, so this is a point we're going to explore, you know, for very soon in the talk, is can you imagine being in such a relationship to life that when gain arises, we're not welcoming it, we're not chasing after it, we're not clinging to it, right? And then when something that's a loss arises, we don't rebel against that fact. We try to find that place of balance, that sense of equanimity. And thus we're abandoning welcoming and rebellion, we're released from birth, aging, death, from sorrows, lamentation, and pain. We're released from suffering and stress, suffering and dukkha. So this is a quick summary of the sutta, and I encourage you to find it online and read it a few times. It's a pretty straightforward sutta, and to kind of reflect on it. So how do we go from this shift from this run-of-the-mill person into this well-instructed person? How do we make that shift? Now, this sutta actually doesn't give a lot of how-to advice. It just tells you kind of the consequences of what happens when we are, you know, relating to a loss or a gain that way. We create suffering or we don't create suffering. So in some ways, it's more of a way of almost evaluating our practice. Because often we have this idea, well, how is my practice doing? You know, as a teacher, when I'm working with a student, I'm getting a sense of their maturity. I often see, it's hard to tell by just their meditative practice. It's hard to tell by how much they're sitting and their insights are arising. That's some measure of it. I think a more important measure is how that practice is integrated in their lives. And these eight are a beautiful way to see how that integration arises. Is to see how well do we meet those gains, those senses of fame, that sense of praise. How do we meet the quality of pleasure? You know, there's a maturity that grows in us of meeting those with wisdom, with understanding, with compassion. The same thing is how do we meet loss and disgrace and blame and pain? You know, understanding how we meet those. So my invitation in this month in this talk is to not, you know, judge yourself for however you are, whether you take yourself as a run-of-the-mill person or a well-instructed person. I think we all have that capacity in different areas. You know, it grows and grows in our hearts as our practice flowers and blooms. But more as a way to kind of almost as a litmus test to see, well, how am I with this loss? How am I with this disgrace or this blame? You know, how am I with this pain? How am I with this gain, with this fame, with this pleasure, this praise? So the Buddha is really pointing toward, in the sutta, this underlining transformation. When he talks about a well-instructed person of the noble ones. So it's not about faking it. It's not about adopting some idea or ideal of what we conceive of this means. Because when we do that, we're kind of really imposing this artificial construct on our own experience. This has a quality of deadening us or repressing and really not acknowledging what is actually present. Because our belief of how we should be can overcome what we actually are. And this is where the idea of equanimity sometimes gets distorted. We have this sense of being, oh, I'm not supposed to be affected by life. And so when I have that reaction arise, I have to somehow dampen that down or hold it in or somehow repress it or ignore it. So we start to pretend that we're equanimous by internally repressing and denying. This way does not work. This way just eventually it does not work. It creates so much internal tension, really blocks us from seeing clearly. And so I think a basis for our practice is really acknowledging and clearly seeing what is present. This is really the essence of Dharma practice, is to see things how they actually are. Just talking about that way we create the world, just learn to see through that creation, actually meet life how it is, including ourselves, including all those parts of ourselves that we judge, that we wish weren't present, things like our lust, like our anger, our envy, our jealousy, our rage, all these kind of shadows, to be able to acknowledge that they're present. Because if they're not acknowledged, how can we meet them with wisdom? If they're not acknowledged, how can we meet them with compassion? One way I like to work with these eight worldly winds is to hold the opposite as one arises for me. So when someone's praising me, I also hold the perspective that there will be blame at some point. When I gain something, to realize, okay, there also will be loss. There's a Zen story of the Zen master who receives this beautiful teacup, but imagines it already shattered. So he relates to it in a very different way. You know, there's a fleetingness to it, a quality of preciousness to it. But there's also realization that, like all things, it will at some point be shattered, some point fall away. I was also noticing for myself that because of that inherent negativity bias, we've spoken about that, how evolutionarily, you know, our species are really designed to notice what's wrong in the environment, what's dangerous. Our attention is hyper primed to focus on what's not good. And we just continue that into ourselves. Okay, I'm judging this about me, you're judging that about me. And so sometimes it's a little harder when blame arises to remember that praise will also arise. It's hard to hold that. So to reflect, okay, hold those both equally, that praise and blame are just part of the spectrum, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. So it helps us find a little bit more of a balance as we're meeting these winds. Now, the underlying transformation that the Buddha was speaking of is to understand our unconscious, unexamined belief in a separate, continuous self. that is substantial and solid. Okay, this is this idea that, okay, here I am going through life. I'm having these experiences, these roles, and it all kind of points back to something that feels very consistent and unchanging. Yeah, sure, I have different moods and different experiences, different mind states, but there's an underlying perspective of me who's having all of those, me who's experiencing all of those. Okay. So the Buddha pointed to this as really the core, one of the core, or the, if that the core insight to understand is that that self is actually something which is also conditioned. It actually arises. Valerie, your whole question's till the end. Okay, that was just a mistake. No worries. And so when those, we see through those, when we see through that belief in self, then these worldly winds respond in a very different way. We meet them with a wise response. But when we still believe in that sense of self, these winds really buffet us. They really shake us to our core. A simple formula to remember is that the more selfing is that connected with the winds, the more creating the sense of self, the more identification, either side of the positive or negative side of it, the more suffering we'll experience. So selfing equals suffering. And so the more we're invested in one of these worldly winds, the more we're sensitive to that praise, sensitive to that blame, the more suffering we'll experience. And this is, of course, we know this. We know that someone blames us for something we don't have a lot of charge around. It's like, yeah, no big deal. Someone blames us for something that we really invested in, that we really care about, that we hold very dear to our hearts and we're proud of. It's a whole different matter, isn't it? And that subjective experience of emotional, mental, physical suffering. This is what happens when that sense of self gets triggered. Or if we were really proud, we get so much praise, so much accolades. If we feel we're on the top of the world, you know, we can feel it's pleasant. It's very pleasant, you know, and we feel so invested in it. But what happens when that changes, when that starts to fade? When something shakes that, that's when the suffering arises. This is really the second noble truth, and also dependent origination. This mechanism of creating the self and the origin of dukkha are really one and the same. One and the same. So these winds, they have the capacity to really generate the sense of who I am. We all know this. We know, we really know who we are when we're being praised. We really know who we are when we're being blamed. So I'm being praised. You know, I feel so excited. I feel that lightness. I feel that quality of the person being praised. Or I'm being blamed. You know, I become that person that we really contract around. And in those moments, our sense of self feels so intact. It feels so solid. So the Buddha's pointing towards seeing that as inherently empty, we seem so far away from it. So in this way, we can actually use these worldly winds as a way of a cue to investigate this sense of self. Now, when I say investigation, I like to think of it as, in some ways, like with mindfulness, how we learn to focus on our breath and our body, start to focus on, you know, notice, be able to aware of emotions arising and thoughts arising. We're coming into this quality of simply allowing them to arise and pass away. It's kind of this objective, kind awareness of knowing what's here and what's arising. Right? Investigation is taking that same quality and directing it to where the suffering is. Seeing where is that suffering? And it's often going into the roots of what's unconscious, what's unseen. That's kind of this momentum of what's under the surface. Like the analogy of the dandelion, that we see the flower and the deep taproot. Investigation is that directed mindfulness to see where that taproot actually goes. Right? And so we can use this in terms of any of these worldly winds, is to see, how is this dukkha arising? How is this identification? How am I claiming this as I, as me and mine? So really the issue is around that self-making, to see where that is. So this week and this month, you know, as the homework directs us, is to start to bring more awareness to these winds. You know, that first step of moving from being a run-of-the-mill person to a well-taught person is to recognize when a wind is blowing on you. It's like, oh, wow, that was a gain. I just received something. I just got something I wasn't expecting, or something well worked and earned, or I lost something. And to notice that, oh, this is gain and this is loss. Stepping back and noticing what's present. And then as we go deeper into it, you can notice, especially those ones which really grip you, notice how you really feel intact. Okay, so this feeling intact, it may be kind of maybe a little abstract, but if you can really talk about your opinions, when you can voice your opinions, where you can feel, you know, I'm just so upset about this, I feel really excited by this, that's all pointing to that sense of self really formed there. So asking you to step back a little bit in those states and notice, oh, there's that sense of me. I really know where I am. I know who I am. I know what I believe, what I'm feeling. I know what I want and what I don't want. It's very clear, you know, there's that sense of self there. Even when we're completely unclear, you know, and diffuse and confused. So practice is learning to see through that, to see through it in a fundamental way, so that just it falls away in a profound way. We'll get back to that in a little bit here. So using these worldly winds as an invitation for investigation, you might pick the ones you're most sensitive to. You're like, I really don't like to be blamed. I really like to be praised. You know, without judgment, just to notice that. I really like pleasure. I really don't like pain. And speaking of pain, we can also start to notice, as we work with these worldly winds, is start to notice where that suffering is, where the pain is in relationship to that worldly wind. Okay, so it's easy to see when those negative winds are present. Okay, you had loss and blame and disrepute and pain, those are really obvious. But to start to see that also the suffering with those positive ones, when we hold on to them, they want them to last longer than they actually are. We want to protect that state. So you start to connect the cause and effect of that identification with the suffering. And start to notice that areas that you really are identified, how there's more suffering around them. And areas that you're not so identified with, it's like, okay, that's all right. I can let that go. It's amazing how it could be something, you know, very simple can be so devastating to lose. You know, just like losing a book that you didn't mean to give away. It's like, oh, I wish I had that book. It can form all this gripping pain around it. Well, something much bigger, you might say, okay, I'm letting that go. So the invitation again is to notice the eight winds, and also notice how invested you are, how identified you are, how you create that sense of self in relationship to that. Now, part of this selfing process is creating the story, creating this narrative, this movie, this play with us as the principal actor. So the whole play starts to unfold, you know, all the backstory, the prologue, the plot points. It all often forms when one of these worldly winds hits us. You know, again, in both the positive and negative winds. When the wind blows one way, the story unfolds that way. When it blows the other way, this other story unfolds. So start to step back again and notice those stories. What the mind, so asking you to look at the mind and not completely believe what your mind is thinking. So, okay, the mind's creating this whole story. Stepping back and noticing. And particularly as we get older, we can start to have more and more experiences of how those stories didn't turn out the way we thought. And yet in the midst of those, they feel so convincing. You know, I was talking to a friend the other day, and just how, you know, with our children, you know, we're both parents, and how, you know, choices I made to come to school at the University of Washington some 30 years ago, those choices aren't pertinent anymore. And yet that led to a whole other unfolding, different pathways to having me sitting here. And I could not have predicted that. There's another Zen story that I think many of you know, of the farmer, very, very poor, you know, not much means, and has just one horse. And one day that horse runs away. And all his neighbors come by to console him and say, "This is so terrible. You've lost your only horse." But our star of the story, the farmer, the wise farmer, says, "Yeah, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe it's terrible, but maybe it's not." So again, this is all pointed to that quality of equanimity, that quality of balance, of not believing the story. And the next day, the horse comes back with a wild horse that's attracted it. So the neighbors are all so happy for him that he has suddenly two horses. Yesterday he had none, now he has two. And again, the farmer says, "Maybe yes, maybe it's good, maybe it's not. Maybe yes, maybe no." And the next day, his son jumps on the wild horse and tries to tame it and falls off and breaks his leg. And again, the neighbors come by and say, "How terrible." And the farmer says, "Maybe yes, maybe no." And the next day, the army comes drafting all the young men, and the young man with his broken leg is released from service. Maybe yes, maybe no. So remember this story as your mind tells you its favorite story. You know, there's worldly winds hit. So yeah, maybe this is good. Maybe this isn't good. You know, my daughter's, you know, getting ready for college and, you know, excited about, you know, certain schools and hoping to get in. And, you know, there, of course, would be disappointment if she doesn't get into her favorite school. But there's this wisdom to know maybe that is actually perfect. Maybe something better will come along, something more suited. Or maybe it will be a great fit. And so you hold that gain and loss with a quality of balance. And you often reflect that our mindfulness practice gives us the ability to learn life's lessons, because life is constantly teaching us through these kind of these gains and these losses, these praises and blames, teaching us how we relate to it that creates more suffering or creates more freedom. And so often we need those lessons to be so loud, but mindfulness allows us this art of really making contact with how things actually are. We create this increased sensitivity, a sense of receptivity to what's arising. So just notice, see what life has to teach you. So we talked a lot about the sense of self and investigating that. And I just want to say a few kind of words about that process of investigating the sense of self. Because it's really easy when you hear that. And I certainly for many years took it this way, that I saw, okay, the sense of self became a problem to solve. I mean, it's in some ways it is. That's the key issue to understand in Dharma. But if I make it a problem, if I start an all-out assault on the sense of self, guess who's leading that charge? It's the sense of self. And it can get super, super subtle. You can be like, you know, feel like you're just so quiet, but you have that subtle pressure to make something other than it is. That's a signpost. Your sense of self is active right there. I like to use this analogy of like if I had a hammer and I made a hole in the wall, and I wanted to try to fix the hole by using the hammer some more, you know, I'm just going to make that hole bigger, because that's just what the hammer does, is makes holes in this analogy. And so same thing with the sense of self. It has a way of forming a locus of stability where there's not. It has the capacity to make something stable out of something that's unstable. Okay, this is who I am. This is what I am. And really all our meditative practices are designed to start to show that fallacy of that. That's why we sit, as we talked about last week, with boundaries, you know, that sitting and your sense of body start, your idea of body starts to fall away, and you're left with the actual experience of it. The idea of body, you know, helps keep that sense of self solid, while that felt experience is much richer, much more alive. So it's not like we vanish. It's actually we open to something much faster. You know, that narrowness falls away, so then we actually see the reality of interconnection, the reality of non-separation. So I think it's much more helpful, as always, for those who come to Tuesday morning meditation, we're talking about this last week, to appreciate more what the sense of self does and how it's been a beautiful tool for your life, how it's really helped you. And often that sense of self needs to be really nourished and feel more and more comfortable in itself, to have no friction with it arising. At the same time, to see what's beyond that, to see the emptiness with it. So we come to that sense of trying to get rid of it, to make it a problem, we've just created a deeper sense of self. Or just kind of reuse that hammer in a different way. So these worldly winds, it's such a rich topic to explore at the end of this Dharma and daily life, because we all experience those big ways and small ways, and learning how to find that as a point of practice to start to transform us from being this kind of the run of the mill, this reactive, unconscious, believing in self, believing our stories, to seeing someone who is well taught, to actually see through those stories, to actually see the nature that this is just life. It's arising as a gain. It's arising as a loss. All right. Let's just sit quietly for a few moments, and then we'll talk about the homework and have some questions. You know, as we sit, there's this quality of things arising, of gaining the breath, of gaining a sensation. And there's a loss as that breath exits her body. And how there's this capacity to be still in the midst of that arising and passing away. Something which doesn't change. This same capacity can meet life's bigger winds of gain and loss, of fame and disgrace, of praise and blame, and pleasure and pain. Thank you. All right. I'd just like to say a few words about the homework for this week. So hopefully you here in the room, you're able to get a copy, and those online, you can see it in the chat. Maybe Dara, you could repost that. So we all experience these eight vicissitudes. It doesn't matter, you know, how skillful we are, how wise we are. These winds still come our way of gain and loss, fame and disgrace, fame and blame, praise and blame. I'm sorry, fame and shame, I should say, praise and blame and pleasure and pain. And notice that the more invested in it and identified we are with these eight, the more suffering we experience. Okay, so you feel the wind, notice there's a lot of suffering. Look at how the investment is, how you create that, how you're really personally invested in that, whatever was lost, whatever was praised. And this week, notice when one of these winds blows your way. Notice the sense of you forms, how the sense of you forms around that wind. And look up the sutta, so the Loka Vipata Sutta, the feelings of the world. And just read it a few times. You know, get used to reading this. Again, it's a very straightforward sutta. We covered it almost entirely tonight. And see what reflections come up. And next week, I'll do a little recap of this talk and then have a chance for you to engage around this topic of these eight worldly winds. So we have some space now for any sharing, any questions you might have. So those online, you can probably raise your virtual hand and we can try to find you. Or if you're in person, you can raise your physical hand. All right, Lauren, go ahead.
Well, I was thinking about a couple of things, and one is that I have always seen equanimity associated with the eight worldly winds, but it seems like compassion sometimes is really important too, because like praise and blame often having kind of a more balanced look, like you were talking about, oh, they're on the same continuum. And if I feel praise now, that feels really good. But I know it's the same, praise and blame are the same continuum, and they're actually the same thing. They're just different points of view, but they're the same quality. And so equanimity does give me balance, but sometimes like gain and loss, if it has to do with someone who's died or something that's really, you know, it's really a loss. You have to kind of move into that emotional. You have to connect really deeply, I think, with the loss. So I was just thinking about that. I think actually that equanimity and compassion really go together a lot, and they kind of help each other. So I wondered what you thought about that.
All right. So how equanimity and compassion go together with these worldly winds. And also you touched on, you know, something like a grief when you lose a loved one, how that, you know, if we had that quality of just, okay, no big deal, we would really feel our hearts have closed off to that experience. And so that's why I think it's really, equanimity is one of those teachings that's so easy to misinterpret, to create that idea that we're supposed to be distant and removed and aloof from life. And I think it's much more helpful to bring that quality of compassion, is to say, okay, where's the suffering? Where's the pain in this experience, in this relationship? And to lead with that. Because as we so much talk about, wisdom and compassion are really one and the same, that there's a wisdom component to compassion and a compassionate part of wisdom. And then when they're really balanced, then that's when the Brahma Viharas take flight. They really have that quality of deepening, and as our Dharma practice does too. And I think that's the big piece here is around that quality of selfing, of that identification. So is it possible to feel deep loss, you know, without that self being so clinging, so intact? You know, and that's a very tricky one. And, you know, I think looking back 2,600 years at these words, it's easy to kind of misunderstand perhaps what the Buddha really meant. There's also the sutta where the Buddha lost his two dearest friends and disciples. And he said, you know, it felt like the light had gone out of the room, out of the world. He felt like, you know, even though he's sitting with 500 people, like he was sitting all alone because of the loss of these two people. So I think I think it's especially with grief, it's something that we need to really meet as a human being, you know, to see that. And part of it is that maturity to be able to, another way we can explore these, I'm kind of rambling here, hopefully that's helpful, Lauren, but we can kind of, our hearts start to be able to meet this capacity of deep loss with a balance. Like we can grieve it, we can feel that. We also have the same perspective that this loss is what all people leave or experience. All people have these, they lose loved ones. And so in that way, you know, that sense of loss and that sense of gain start to have this much broader perspective. You know, so it's more that the more narrow we get, the more contracted we get, the more suffering we get. And I think you're right that compassion really needs to be embedded in our equanimity. The phrase that we're equally close to all things, we can take it as being equally distant to all things. I think it's much better to think of it as equally close to all things. And that closeness is an act of compassion. I don't know if that helped at all, Lauren.
Yeah, it did. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. All right. How about anyone here in the room? Yeah, Deb.
It's better if I sit here. Oh, okay. Although we are all subject to each of these winds, I'm wondering if there could be a proclivity that we have towards some of them more than a little more than towards others, or perhaps a sensitivity that's a little deeper. For instance, I myself notice that I'm more prone to, I guess, the winds of blame. Now, part of that is the negativity thing that you were talking about. But I've noticed for a long time that when someone offers praise to me, I almost immediately seek to dampen it down. Mm-hmm. Like, no, you really don't understand. I'm really not a very nice person. Actually rather evil. Actually haven't done anything for you lately. You just haven't been paying attention. You know, it's quite active. And I seek to really push it off. But if there's blame, if there's an atom of it, you know, in the air, a molecule, you know, I seek it out. It just feels so much more comfortable to me to be in blame rather than praise. Praise is very, very uncomfortable for me. I have to do a lot of really conscious, active work to just even sit quietly with it. I don't notice that so much with the other pairs of winds. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if that is a typical response or something that you've encountered before, or this is just being human.
Yes, thank you, Deb. I'm just trying to orchestrate this. That's what I want. There, oops, there I am back. Sorry for my t- technical goofs there. Well, Deb, I bet if we took a poll, you're probably not alone. Yeah, I mean, I see a lot of nods, and I see a lot of nods online. In fact, I would wager that, you know, that particular one of praise and blame is a very, very prominent one in our culture. You know, and why that is, you know, we could speculate that, or probably, you know, find some sociological answers to that. But the fact is, how do we work with that? How do we meet that? And I think, you know, as you said, that we can, you know, have one that we really, that pairing that we really are oriented toward. And, you know, all that you described there is really that mechanism of how you learn to create that sense of self. That, you know, your whatever conditioning you had is, again, many, if not all of us, are really hypersensitive to being blamed, you know, and there can be that sense of, okay, I'm more comfortable being, you know, less than, you know, versus that sense of being praised, you know, and it could be, you know, vice versa with that. And so that's the, you know, if you step back to the, you know, you spoke about it very clearly and articulately, but stepping back and seeing that just as a story, as almost a mythology that you believe in. And then so many of us believe in. See if you can step back and say, okay, here's this whole mechanism that's arising and, you know, holding that in a lighter way to see if you can hold, maybe a good start is to see how, if I can hold praise and blame equally. That's going to be a huge step, right? To be able to receive praise, to receive accolades and not to discount it, not to dodge it, not to deflect it, but to argue against it, but just to really receive it. You know, that's a huge piece there to do that. But by doing that, I mean, there's a whole psychological piece that's important. But from a dharmic standpoint, you're really challenging that foundational belief in who you take yourself to be. Because when you're, you know, you said, I'm more comfortable being blamed. That's your default. That's like what's intact there. Dharma takes us to where we're not intact. We're not sure who we are. When you're being blamed, you know exactly who you are. When you're deflecting praise, again, I'm saying you, but, you know, just because you asked the question, but again, this speaks to so many of us, you know, including myself. You know, we learn to, you know, we feel very intact there. So next time, see it more as when you feel, when someone's praising you, just see if you can accept it. You don't have to make a story about it. You don't have to internalize it, but just allow it to flow through you. It's like, okay, letting it flow through me. Like if someone gave you a Christmas gift that you didn't really like, you would say, oh, thank you. You still acknowledge that. And then maybe you got home, you would throw it away. But, you know, hold on to it for a day or so and just kind of, okay, let me feel that. And realizing from a dharmic standpoint, going to where you're not so defined is a big piece of the work. I wager that as we explore it this week, we'll find that we may have some of our top pairs, the ones we really like, that we really orient toward, and other ones which we just kind of don't really pay attention to. All right, so I see Iris, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thank you. I certainly relate to Deb's comment about, do we have proclivities more so for one or the other? And I'm sure I do. And, you know, I imagine it's, you know, tied into, you know, early experiences in life and psychology and personality and all of that jazz. And what is so obvious, which you spoke about, Tim, is how it's connected to selfing, and any kind of selfing is painful. You know, even the praise, so painful. And then the more difficult, the four more difficult ones are even more painful, more suffering, but even the ones that we might think are positive, it just causes contraction in my body. So, you know, really, really interesting and to understand that sense of self and the suffering it causes. Not easy to let go of, but certainly something to look at and, as you invited, to investigate.
Yes, thank you, Iris. Yeah, it is. It does that contraction, that identification. It does hurt. It does create that quality of deep pain. And to realize too that it's that's because we're relating to it in a certain way. We're really reinforcing that pathway of contraction of self, really. But there's no reason why, you know, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, you know, the whole eight can't be something that's actually a form of delight. You know, delight that, oh, there's praise here, there's blame here, there's a way of opening to it that it just flows through you. And there's a way of it not being so sticky. That's probably a good way to say it, that there's not that stickiness. So often we do have to meet that stickiness to understand the stickiness, but to realize that the whole purpose of meeting that stickiness is to release it. So then that, you know, praise arises, blame arises, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain, and they can all flow through us, that we can meet them fully and also release them fully. So that way it has this wonderful effect of making the good things in our life, you know, all these positive sides, we can really delight in them, but not hold on to them when it's time for them to leave. We don't take them so personally. And so freeing the personalization of it actually lets us experience it more fully. And the same thing with the painful ones, that we can experience them fully, but not taking it personally. So they have this capacity to meet those rubs of life, those difficulties of life. So to also notice that too, Iris, I bet that there's times when there's some areas that you're able to just meet a gain or a loss, a praise and a blame, without a whole lot of fanfare. Just, oh, this is just arising. And there's almost see if there isn't a quality of delight in that. It's like, oh, wow, this is, I'm being praised, I'm being blamed, and humor with that. You know, it might be stuff that you don't take super personally. It might be, you know, your cat telling you it's time for dinner or something. But you know, you can feel that lightness. So don't forget to also look for the lightness, you know, for all of us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Iris. All right, back here in the physical room. Yes.
Something came up for me, and I'm not sure if I'm trying to insert this into the winds, but there is definitely a wind that's been blowing. the category is fame and disgrace. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'm in disgrace, really, but before the pandemic, I was involved in a number of organizations and groups where I had responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And the responsibilities brought me into a situation where I would be the person up front. I would be the person who was known. I would be the person who was being called upon. And when the pandemic hit, a lot of that disappeared. The groups fell apart. My roles weren't needed anymore. And that became, I think, about more like invisibility versus disgrace. And I realize how much it wasn't that I was egoically enjoying fame, but I felt the responsibility. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was a job to be up front, to be there. I felt the pressure. And I'm really enjoying not having the pressure. I like it being invisible. And so I'm thinking that I'm feeling aversion actually toward the fame, whatever the fame would be, rather than having that open attitude that you've described about seeing both ends. I don't want the fame. I don't want to go back. So it's difficult to find some equanimity with that pendulum.
Yes, it is. Yeah, that sense of the pendulum and then changing circumstances and how you orient to that and, you know, being, it sounds like, you know, happy or fine being in that role before the pre-pandemic and then, you know, now feeling that aversion toward it. And so, you know, again, the whole invitation is just to notice, oh, there's that orientation that comes up around being in front of people or not being in front of people, being invisible versus being prominent. And just say, oh, let's be curious about that. Let me meet that. Just like, you know, meeting, being praised or being blamed, you know, meeting all of that, you know, meeting those qualities and saying, okay, that's, you know, that deep sense of acknowledgement. Let me actually see deeply what's here. So of course there's the superficial part of it and there's the deeper part of it. And there's a deeper way that you form around both of those poles or those ways of being in the world. And just bring a quality of lightness, of curiosity, of interest. And then we start to have, by doing that, we start to see through these more and more. We start to see through our identification with them. And the other side of that, then is that more that spontaneity that, yeah, okay, I'll get up, I'll make a announcement and then I'll fade back into invisibility. And there's not a strong preference one way or the other, but it's done from that internal work instead of faking it. So I think that's why it's so important to really deeply acknowledge that.
Real quick, I was when Deb was talking and she was talking about the blame end of like blame, that's good. I'll take that. That'll keep me invisible.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, Emery, do you like to go?
Yes, thank you. I have a question about action. Because I understand what you've been talking about with kind of being that rooted tree and the winds, all these eight winds kind of blow us around and we observe it and experience it and investigate it, but kind of stay balanced and centered with it. But my question is, like, let's say with pain, your pain or another's pain, when do we take action to relieve pain? And how do we know when it's the right time to take action? Or when do we know that it's time to just experience the pain and notice the pain and notice how we're selfing with the pain? Does that make sense? I feel like, yeah, I've asked this question over and over again in different ways. But I still don't get it.
Sure, Emery. Yeah, that's a great question. I think it resonates with a lot of us because I think that's one of the that transition from practicing just on the cushion, you know, practicing with our own experience. Then how do we actually bring that into our lives? You know, and relationship to pain is such a beautiful and difficult one to explore. I was thinking about that movie Lorenzo's Oil. You know, so there's the basic story is this young child has this very rare condition and is terminal, but the father decides to do all this research and discovers this oil that cures him. But as a Dharma practitioner, an early movie, I was like, I was already ready to go to just grieving the child's, you know, passing. I was like, okay, I'm going to just okay, I can open to that. I can feel that suffering. And this guy's like, you know, doing all this medical research. He's not a doctor, and he, you know, is able to cure him. And so it's like that, you know, it's really an ongoing, in some ways, a Zen riddle. It's like, okay, what is the right way? And I think the only advice I can really give you is to know yourself really deeply, you know, to know yourself deeply and then be fully available to the feedback you're getting from life. Okay, so knowing yourself deeply, you can start to notice when, you know, you're just really uncomfortable with the fact that your loved one's suffering. You know, there's like, just, I can't, you know, especially as sometimes we've talked about this around children and our children, it's, you know, hard to have our children suffer when we, especially when we can come in and swoop in and make it all better, or at least apparently. And yet there's this, some lessons we can only learn through suffering, you know, or learn through those natural consequences or through trial and error. And so I think the big thing is to start to notice when there's that, just that uncomfortableness with the fact that there is suffering, you know, versus, okay, when there's a, at least times when it's really clear that, okay, this is the right action, it just kind of flows from a different place in me. You know, the compassion response is not, you know, from a neurotic place, or I'm not saying that you're neurotic, but I'm neurotic, but, you know, there's, there's that, you know, enmeshed way, that codependent way that it arises. And sometimes there's just this very direct way, this clear way. And yet even that, you know, you have to see, okay, how is it received? How is it responded to? And I think always, you know, asking permission is so helpful, you know, to ask, you know, do you need some help? Would you like some help? And if you make that a habit, you'll be surprised how often people say they don't really want help. You know, and then of course, sometimes they want help, but they don't know how to ask, or they don't deserve it. There's all that complexity to it. But it's just, you know, knowing yourself very deeply, noticing the body, noticing all the pathways that you tend to go down around relationships and, you know, codependency and competency and all those things. And, you know, and holding that, yes, sometimes people really need to suffer. They need to feel that themselves. And sometimes you need to discover that Lorenzo's oil that's going to cure them. So yeah, I don't have any easy answer to that. It's really an alive question, and it's probably different each time with this, even with the same person, you know, because really that person's arising in that moment and you're arising in that moment. Just, you know, keep your eyes open externally to them and also to yourself. All right. Thank you, Emery. All right. Maybe one more, and then we have some announcements. Yes, Carlito.
How does impermanence fit into the eight winds? I mean, for me currently, you know, my experience of impermanence is really closely associated with loss. But, oh, really? Okay.
Well, I think she's in the room, so.
Oh, I'm sorry. Talking louder in the mic will not help.
Yes.
So, yeah, how does impermanence fit into the eight winds? And for me personally, it's closely correlated with loss. But so just listening to the discussion, I mean, does one get to a point where it's like, yeah, impermanence is a thing, everyone experiences it, you know, and you, there's kind of a balance with that realization. I'm just curious how it fits in, because impermanence seems such one of the core, you know, parts of Buddhism. So,
yes.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Thank you. So the question is around impermanence and how this fits in, and also noticing how impermanence is so connected to loss in your own experience, at least right now in your experience. So impermanence is really the underlying, if you read the sutta, there's a nice little verse or poem at the end when, you know, the Buddha is talking about the arising and passing away, the impermanent nature of all of these things. So that's really embedded in this whole topic, is that any gain, any praise, any fame, any pleasure is all impermanent, as to the pain and the loss and the shame and the disgrace, the blame, all those are all impermanent. So it's just like when we try to fix it as being permanent, that's when you experience difficulty. And, you know, certainly impermanence works in our favor for the painful things when they pass, and it works against us when the pleasurable things fall away. And so the more we can realize, okay, this is just the nature of things, that things arise and they pass away. And sometimes in our practices, we're more oriented toward the passing away of things, and that's where that grief comes in. But that's just half of the equation. There's also the arising part. So sometimes you might want to emphasize your awareness of the arising of things, the things, how things come to fruition, how things are born, and that kind of beauty of that. And just to start to find that place of balance between those two.
Yeah, I guess you're just saying, and when one experiences impermanence in that context, then just go to the gain part and try to that half of that wind, and kind of see that as well to try to help balance it.
Yes, I wasn't thinking of that exactly, but that's a good strategy, is start to notice the bias, how we're, you might be focused more on the
right,
the losses and the blame and all that part, and the things fading away, and start to rebalance by noticing these other aspects. Because part of it is, like, we, you know, a lot of us have these biases of our attention, what we pay attention to, and learning to investigate that, see through it, but also just a skillful means to balance it to something opposite of that.